Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Don't forget to check out and contribute to your Uncommon Economic Indicators, our ongoing crowdsourcing project on the economy. Post a photo, a video, or a story, or call our special hotline at 1-800-543-2543 about the economic indicators in your neighborhood. Here's one that came in yesterday about one of those private school auctions. This says, you can imagine our surprise. I'm sorry, public school auctions. A public school auction. You know how the PTA sometimes gets together and auctions off stuff to raise money for the school? This listener writes, you can imagine our surprise when more items were available this year and more people attended this year's auction than in any previous year. The three Bill Telepan dinners went for $9,000 each. They went for less than that in past years. The most plausible explanation is that more families who would have sent their children to private schools are attending this school. There is no longer enough room for all the children who live in the catchment area to attend my son's school. So one uncommon economic indicator, more donations at a public school auction. Well, the latest unemployment figures in New York City aren't pretty. February saw the jobless rate take the biggest one-month jump ever since they started keeping these records, I think, in the 70s. The March numbers aren't out yet, but we're likely to remain in the area of 8% or even higher, and that's just the official unemployment number in New York City. All this compared to just 4.4% at this time last year. So as more and more New Yorkers look for new jobs, and many have to turn to the service industry to find them, the more pressure there is on the job market. And now comes news that the playing field for those looking for jobs, at least in one sector, continues to be uneven. The Restaurant Opportunity Center of New York has just released a study that looks at hiring practices in fine dining restaurants throughout the city, and we're told that racial discrimination persists, especially when it comes to hiring waitstaff. Joining us to discuss the study is Reka Iani Rodriguez, co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center. Reka, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
First, talk about the methodology of the study. What did you do and how did you do it?
Yeah, this was a very unique methodology that we used to get at discrimination. The meat of the study was called matched pair testing, or otherwise known as auditing. This is where you send two equally qualified candidates of different race or ethnicities into the workplace to apply for a position. In this case, we were looking at the waitstaff position, like you mentioned, because in the waitstaff position in these fine dining restaurants in the city, you're earning a lot of money. You can earn anywhere from $35,000 to $100,000 and even more in some of these really high-end four-star restaurants. So this was the main part of the study, was sending people to over 181 fine dining restaurants throughout Manhattan, the most high-profile, most highly visible, celebrity chef restaurants that you see on TV. And we sent them to apply for these positions.
And?
The results were interesting. In the end, what we found is that workers of color, and one thing I just want to point out is that the workers of color always had slightly better credentials. The resumes always reflected a little bit more work experience or a little bit better, restaurants that they worked at than their white counterpart. Workers of color were less likely than white workers or white testers to get an interview in the first place. They were half as likely to get a job offer than their white counterparts. And they were twice as likely to be probed or scrutinized during the interview process, meaning the employer couldn't believe that a worker of color, especially a worker of color with an accent, can possibly have the experience that they stated to have had. So, what's interesting is that in the end, what we were able to find is that one in every three workers of color were discriminated against. And this is a much higher rate of discrimination than we see where testing has been applied in other industries, where it's more like one in every four or one in every five.
Were you able to discern, did you have enough testers to discern a pattern within different minority groups or comparing different minority groups or people of color and how they were discriminated against. For example, I've heard that blacks who are immigrants from Jamaica or Africa and sound it tend to have an easier time getting a job than African-American blacks.
That's interesting. We did use a whole wide range of different minority groups, so it wasn't just folk. There was African American, there was Latino, there was, you know, South Asian, there was East Asian. We didn't necessarily do a comparison between the different minority groups, but one thing that we did do is a comparison between different immigrant groups. So, for example, we would test, let's say, African American with a Jamaican immigrant, right? And there was no difference in treatment between those groups when we sent them. However, when we did a U.S.-born white worker with a European white worker, we found that European workers had a 23% higher likelihood of success than their white U.S.-born counterpart.
Isn't that interesting? So having a European accent, it was the accent, right?
That's right.
Enhanced your chances of getting a job as a waiter at a fine dining restaurant.
Exactly. And the reason why that's so important is because oftentimes employers say it's not about that the person's black or that they're Latino or whatever. It's because that their accent is so hard for customers to understand, and they therefore lack the proper language capability. So we said, okay, well, let's see if they feel the same when somebody has a European accent. And we're finding that in European accents, you know, employers view this as chic or sophisticated or more in line with the image that they're trying to sell.
So let's open the phones on this and take some calls from applicants to, and let's keep it in this narrow job category since this is what the study was on, for waiter positions, waitress positions, and other positions at fine dining restaurants in the New York City area. And especially if you are a person of color who has ever applied for a job like this, do you think that you have ever been the subject of discrimination, that you didn't have the right look or the right sound to qualify by the lights of the management? And maybe you want to call and tell us how, when you apply for jobs, you try to sell yourself if you think you're going to be the subject of discrimination going in. Do you have a bias to overcome? And if you think there is a bias for you to overcome, how do you try to overcome it, or do you just kind of hope for the best? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Anyone who's been in the position, and in a minute or two we'll open it up to anyone else as well, for Reka Iani Rodriguez, co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center. 212-433-9692 or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. By the way, how did the Restaurant Opportunity Center define fine dining? Are you going to release a five-star rating guide to the discriminatory restaurants of New York?
Well, the way that we defined it is by, you know, we had to come up with the sample size of the different restaurants. And what we did is we said, okay, let's take the restaurants that are, A, you know, Insta Gap's top rated in all these different New York Magazine top rated, the highest grossing sales according to Restaurants Nation News and Restaurants and Institutions. We were taking those six different categories to see which ones are the highest profile, most successful or most profitable restaurants in the end, and which ones in that case provide the most living wage or highest paid positions.
Now, there's a question from a listener on our website. A listener asked, were these qualifications on the resume made up? Were these actual people who were qualified to work? I guess the listener wants to know if they weren't really, you know, experienced wait people, maybe the owners sniffed them out.
Well, in almost every situation, there's two things. Yes, they were made up. They had to be made up because that had to be controlled for. We couldn't let people's real qualifications come into play. But the thing to keep in mind is that most of the testers were actual servers in restaurants or had experience in the restaurant industry. And even more significant was that each of the testers would go through very, very intensive training, you know, 18-hour training in fine dining service with the Restaurant Opportunity Center. But there was never a situation where one tester had more, you know, actual life experience than the other.
And restaurateurs, by the way, you also can call. What do you look for, especially if you're affiliated with what might be classified a fine dining establishment. What do you look for in waitstaff? Do you ever, are you willing to admit that you ever take the race or the ethnicity of an applicant to be a waiter or a waitress into account? Do you ever think how they're going to be perceived by customers who may not be as open-minded as you think you are or anything like that? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Grant in Glen Cove, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling, Grant.
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to speak with you.
Great to have you.
Anyways, I'm originally from Arizona. I've traveled throughout the country, parts of Europe and the Middle East. I've worked in all the big cities in America and parts of Canada. And I want to say, unfortunately, the hospitality industry has a lot of racism. It's just part of the game. And I will say I'll agree that your people who have European accents, especially in fine dining establishments, have a tremendous edge over us American counterparts.
In your perception, Grant, is the racism that's rampant in the hospitality industry just from hate in people's hearts? Is it a perceived business advantage that's motivating it, or is it possible to say?
I would actually agree with all three. It's impossible to say first hand. Second of all, it does give a perceived notion of a certain standard. If you go into a high-end fine dining establishment in the city, people expect a certain standard, a certain level of sophistication, and that persona gives it to them.
Thank you for your call. Enrique Iani Rodriguez, boy, this is the oldest discriminatory pitfall in the book, what they used to call front desk appearance, when they wouldn't hire black people to be receptionists.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one thing I just want to say in response to Grant's response was that it's interesting. We would even send in testers who were, let's say, African descent with French accents. And in fact, I'm thinking of a particular tester in real life who had significant wine experience, significant, you know, experience working in different French restaurants. And he was actually one of the testers that got discriminated against in quite a number of different tests. And so, yes, it is totally about image. And I think it is very profit-driven for the most part. I don't think employers are always thinking that they're acting, you know, with racial motives. I think they're basing their decisions many times on assumptions and stereotypes about who, in the end, is going to be able to sell this fine dining, you know, service to customers. And for that reason, so many workers of color who are otherwise qualified get left out because of that.
So, Reka, here is actually a defense of that practice on our comments page. Someone wrote, obviously, these practices are based on the restaurant owner's experience of what works or doesn't work. It seems you want the restaurant owners to engage in social engineering.
Well, I don't think that's the situation at all. Like I said, I think that there's assumptions that they're making, and what that means in the end is that they're making assumptions and never giving the person the opportunity to try it out and see if they're actually working. So it's sort of perpetuating this kind of segregation or discrimination that exists rather than saying, okay, this is illegal. This in the end can lead me to a lot of lawsuits, and it's starting to happen more and more. Let me try to do what is right and what is legal, and in the end, I can profit from this and I can be successful. I think it's having, you know, perpetuated a culture of exclusion for so long that employers aren't thinking of the other way of doing things.
Britta in Hell's Kitchen, you're on WNYC. Hello, Britta.
Hi. I just had a question for the researcher. I wonder how attractiveness was factored in as part of the research, and, you know, were you able to control for that, or... because, you know, it could be racism on one hand, but it could also be combined with class and attractiveness on the other hand.
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing that we wanted to make sure of doing is that each tester, we had a control for everything. So each tester that we paired up, we paired up according to height. We paired up according to the way that they answered questions, their mannerisms, their mm-hmm. level of assertiveness. We had to be able to pair for all those sort of things possible. And you're right, you know, it was us making the measure of attractiveness and appearance, but we did our best to make sure that it was as controlled for as possible and that they did match up physically and otherwise.
Were you ever able to, you know, hold out race from attractiveness and, you know, kind of do that measurement?
I don't know what you mean by holdout race. I mean, we just had to say, okay, here's two people of different races and ethnicities, and we've got to look at what some of the more objective characteristics of appearance or attractiveness might be, such as, you know, height, let's say, or weight, or, you know, how clear the skin was. You know, it's sort of those were the ways that we were able to, the only objective ways we were able to go about doing it.
Like, you're a cute white guy and you're a cute black guy, we're going to pair you up. Did you go there?
To some extent, yeah, we had to. We had to, because we want to be able, we know how important appearance is, and we had to be able to control for that as best as possible.
Deborah in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I was wondering if you found any sort of in sex in terms of getting hired. In my experience, I've been really qualified. I've worked in the restaurant industry for about 8 years, and I've had trouble getting hired at fine dining restaurants that seem to only hire men. I've definitely been to restaurants where I've noticed all the waiters are male, and then it's the same thing at other restaurants, but it seems to be more that men are more present in fine dining.
That's so right, Deborah. What we did not do is we did not pair men and women in this test and study. That has been done in Pennsylvania by another researcher. We did not pair them, but what we did do is we did canvassing of 45 different fine dining Manhattan restaurants at the same group of restaurants that we tested. And what this meant really is that research assistants went into all these different restaurants and literally did the demographic canvassing of the front of the house, counting who was male, who was female, and in which positions they were holding. And one thing that we found is that, you know, 70% of the, you know, the highest front-of-the-house positions, such as manager and maitre d' and bartender and server, were held by white males. And so, you know, females do hold front-of-the-house positions. They have the overwhelming majority of the host positions because they're the sort of the first face that you see when they walk into the restaurant, but they don't hold these higher-level positions where you're making, you know, $50,000, $60,000 a year.
Right, and you have stats in your report that workers of color earn an average of 11% less than a white person of the same qualifications,
mm-hmm.
but women pay a 22% gender tax. That's twice as much salary loss as the race tax.
That's right, and that's controlling for experience, education, qualifications. That's right.
Now, what's your theory? Do you have a theory on that? Because if restaurateurs are perceiving that blacks and Latinos and Asians are going to scare away these high-end customers who they want, does the same really apply to women over men?
I think with women it has to do, well, first of all, I think the gender thing has to do with the level of upscale of the restaurant, the level of how four stars, how traditional is it? I mean, when you're talking about maybe some of the more trendy fine dining restaurants, some of the newer restaurants, you might not have that same level of gendered positions like you do in some of these very old school Italian or French restaurants where their perception is women are not, you know, women do not belong in these positions. They don't know about wine the same as men do. They don't know about food the same. They don't know about service the same. So I do think those stereotypes exist the higher up, or maybe the more stars you get into some of these old fine dining restaurants. But I think that gendered positions, the gender notions of positions still do exist throughout fine dining period, that women are the ones that are sort of the front of the house. When you first walk in, your guests, you first walk in, you're greeted by a woman who's soft and pleasant and can seat you. And then when you get into, you know, having to order the wines and the foods and you have questions about it, you know, it's the male. It's the male who's able to guide you in that way.
Let's get one more person's story out here. Billy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Billy.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
I worked in a very Tony Hotel restaurant in Soho, specifically in the lobby that was closed off to the public. It was very, you know, movie stars, all of that. And I did not drink. I was very, you know, I was very straight-edged. And everyone else was white, save for the African beauty queen that was the hostess in the cafe area. I was accused of stealing, and I was the only person of color, and everyone knew that the individual that was stealing was a person that had a drug problem, and many of the people there had a drug problem, but management and everyone turned to me and blamed everything on me. And I am very much convinced that it was because of my race. There was an assumption.
That's a terrible story.
And it was pretty much said.
That's a terrible story. When you applied for that job, did you feel that you had to, I don't know, you know, cross any barrier that you might not have in a different kind of restaurant? And did you do anything to do that?
Well, someone mentioned earlier, it was because it was in Soho and it was very trendy. It was kind of based on looks. You had to bring a picture and all of that. But that was a bit of a barrier. And the application process was, I think it was kind of silly. You had to, you know, take a test about liquors and all of that. But I think they were really looking for look. That was about it. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make sure that the right looking people and you had to have a minimum requirement of, you know, skill. And they kind of taught you on the job a bit, but it wasn't so much about skill, it was about look.
Billy, thank you very much. And just in our last minute here, Rekha, any advice for people of color who are applying to work in these high-end restaurants on, you know, just how to maximize your chances of getting through this discriminatory barrier?
Well, one thing I don't want to do is put the burden on the applicants in this situation, because in reality, if they have the experience and they have the qualifications, they should be able to get the same opportunity. My advice is more towards the industry itself. And my advice to employers is to understand that, A, you know, there's a lot more lawsuits coming out. There's a lot of workers who are starting to catch on what's going out, and they're not afraid to challenge their workplaces in the same way that they used to. And the other thing is for employers to start seeing that there's a lot of successful restaurants out there, and I don't mean successful for 10 years. I mean for 15, 20 years, who have promoted workers from within, who have good practice, good, fair, objective hiring and promotion practices for all workers and who do succeed in the end. So the hope is that the industry changes its practices more than, you know, the applicants of color should have to.
Rekha Iani Rodriguez, co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center, which just released this study of pairing applicants of color and not to apply at fine dining restaurants for jobs, and the results of discrimination found. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll take our last few minutes today for your eulogies for the Guiding Light going off the air after 72 years. Any Guiding Light fans out there, what was the best moment of the Guiding Light that you ever saw? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Your eulogies for the Guiding Light.